Welcome to Missing and Not Forgotten, the official podcast of the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency. I'm Sean Everett, DPAA's Media Relations Chief, and your host. Thank you for joining us. Marine Captain Ronald Forrester was the bombardier navigator of an A-6A intruder who went missing when his plane disappeared during a nighttime combat mission over the northern part of North Vietnam in December 1972. After decades of searching, Captain Forrester was identified and accounted for in December 2023 and buried with full military honors at Arlington National Cemetery on October 7th, 2024. In our last episode, we spoke with Karenie Forrester, Captain Forrester's daughter, about her experiences over the years.
On this episode, we are talking to Captain Dave Kim and Captain Will Ryan, both of whom have been team leads on recovery missions to find or attempt to find Captain Ronald Forrester. Dave, why don't you start off? Give me a little bit of an introduction. Tell me a little bit about yourself and how you are connected to Ron Forrester.
Hey, Sean. Good morning. I'm Dave. Been with the agency about for 4 years, now since 2020. Been in the Army since 2003. Being connected to the Forrester, that was my very first mission when I arrived at DPA. We went out in May of 2021, and that was our first mission. And I got to meet Ms. Forrester the following year at the annual government brief in Washington, D.C.
Awesome. Will, give me a little bit about your background and how you're connected to Captain Forrester.
Okay, good morning, Sean. I've been in the agency about 2 years. I came from Fort Liberty. I was on the two last JFAs for Ron Forrester, so I elected to go back-to-back missions. The site meant a lot to me. The individuals meant a lot to me, and I really wanted to kind of hone in and help close that site.
So you just mentioned something that a lot of people may not think about when they think about our people who are out in the field, but that the service members that you're looking for meant a lot to you. Why do you think that the service members do mean a lot to the teams who go out looking for them?
Well, there's a great open source article. I think a lot of the excerpts come from Larry, his younger brother, and talked about his upbringing. So, like, you know, talks about Ron, you know, making a parachute, about to jump off the roof before his dad, you know, tells him to get off. He was an Aggie, so my mom was also an Aggie. My grandparents lived down in Texas, and just it's easy to relate to him and his training progression as well. You know, like some of the letters, how he basically, you know, I have two boys myself, and kind of like writing back home and saying, give Karenie a kiss for me. So it's easy to relate to that kind of stuff. And then making it personal for a team is very important. So like telling that story throughout the mission is an easy way to motivate a team. So that's kind of what I did, was kind of capture his story and the letters he wrote back home. And I just got really close to this case. You know, I finished up with that mission and I wanted to go right back to Vietnam. So I think I had maybe like a 15-day turn or something like that. So I went right back to the same site.
So it meant enough to go back out into the rice paddies and deal with all of the things that you have to deal with there right away. So you were out there for what, probably total time, 2 or 3 months?
Well, in total, JFA in Vietnam is about 51 days, so probably about 102 days on that mission, and then about 90 days on site, something around that area.
Wow. Wow, that's pretty amazing. Dave, what about you? You said you actually have gotten the chance to meet Ron's daughter, Karenie. How did that come about? Was that an on-purpose kind of thing at the Vietnam annual government briefing?
No, actually, it was just a random chance. Everybody was getting seated. There was an open seat by a table that I was trying to sit down, and I sat down, started talking to them, and I saw the name on the name tape that she had, and it clicked into my head that I was on her dad's side the year prior, back in 2021. So when that happened, I got really nervous and very excited that I get to meet the daughter of the site that I worked on. Actually, it was 2 years ago. So in 2021, when I got to meet them in 2023. So when she was sharing her story, everything was all clicking. That's like, oh, I was on her dad's site. So a few hours later, I talked with service casualty if I could introduce myself to her that I was on her dad's site. And that's how we clicked. But it was all just a random chance.
Wow.
There was an open seat and I just sat on her table.
That's pretty amazing. Whether you believe stuff happens for a reason or that it's everything's coincidence, that's still a pretty amazing happenstance. Now, you've both been on that site. Dave, when you went out there, did you all find anything that pointed to Captain Forrester?
When we were out there, we were finding just a lot of aircraft wreckages, parts of the aircraft, and possible life support equipment, but nothing that would lead an identification. But everything that we found was correlating to there was a crash out there, and we're in the right vicinity.
Awesome. And then that led to the missions that you went on, Will, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So I basically, used Captain Kim here, and then the process and method he used in that rice paddy with water control measures, copper damming, all that kind of stuff. We did the exact same thing, and we just expanded that area. We just wanted to dig as much as possible. So if you can picture like maybe half a football field worth of copper damming with sandbags, so maybe 12,000 sandbags just to block off the water in the rice paddy, and then we had to pump all that out. And then once that dried, we could actually start excavating cleanly and moving forward. So we kind of just piggybacked off of his efforts.
When you all were out there, when you finally found something, first kind of describe what that moment was like and how it made you feel.
Kind of in shock, you're kind of really in a haze, and then like euphoric right after that, you kind of have that rush go across your body. Relief is what I kind of felt. I don't know if I could speak exactly like the incident I'm talking about. Is it okay if I go into further detail?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so like I was on at the time on the wet screen station, and then Sergeant Cook was like right off to my right side, one screen down, and she comes up to me and taps me on the shoulder, and it's basically, at the time looked like a credit card, and she like held that out to me. It's like, I think we found something. And I picked it up and I looked at it, and it had Forrester's last name on it, and there was a date on there as well, and I think the F was basically kind of cut off. The card was not complete, of course, but you could clearly see, starting with the O and maybe a little bit of F, that spelled out Forrester. And it was actually a gas card from that era, because like credit cards at the time was like pretty new thing, but they had gas cards. And then, I kind of looked at the backside and I looked at the year and matched it up online. It's like, sure enough, like this is the right year with this timeline. And it was just a pretty surreal moment at that time that we found that piece of media. A Forrester. And then, of course, we bring over the SRE, and everyone's excited. And at that time, we're slowly finding, little pieces of osseous, and we're finding, teeth as well. So I was able and fortunate enough to find a premolar in the springs as well. And, you're looking at a lot of rock all day, and it's 122 out with it, it's pretty hot, it's humid, and you're just keeping focused throughout the entire day. And, sure enough, that like, I was just going through the rock, and I picked it up, and, I stared at it and I washed it off and I stared at it some more. And I was looking at the root of the tooth and I flipped it over and you could see the outline of the tooth itself. And it's a tooth. It's, when it wasn't perfectly wide or anything like that, but obviously, we got the SRE over there and he said it's human, and pretty good moment to keep the team motivated. And at least for that mission, like throughout, we found personal media, both Chipman and Ron as well. So it was easy to keep that team motivated for both missions, essentially.
Yeah, I bet. It sounds like it. I didn't realize, I think, that you were the one who actually found the tooth.
So there was a couple teeth found on site. I personally can't, say like, hey, this one belonged to Ron. There was a couple pieces of osseous and a decent amount of teeth found on that site throughout the two missions itself. But yeah, I was one individual that ended up finding a tooth.
Very cool. Very cool. And for the listeners that may not know what they mean when they say osseous material is possible bone. Now, it's not always human bone. Sometimes it's animal bone, just given where the stuff may be. But just wanted to clear that up for any listeners that may not quite know what osseous meant. Now, talking about these recovery missions and what you all do as a team lead on these recovery missions, Dave, what does a team lead do on a recovery mission?
So the team leader is the guys in charge of the entire operation. So planning stuff, we plan the mission, we coordinate with our detachment personnel, we coordinate with the different person at DPAA to make sure that we are successful. Our team is trained. We have the resources to go out there. And once we go on site, we support the scientific recovery expert, our archaeologist or anthropologist, that he or she is successful by getting them resources, doing a lot of coordination, making sure we have the right tools or right instruments to do the mission out there. We also in charge of the safety of our team, the welfare of the team, and good order discipline. With the team sergeant, as well as the team sergeant, myself, we set up the work schedule, who's on the dig site for the day, rotating through, making sure that our guys are, and also the Vietnamese, our counterparts, are in good spirit, are well hydrated since it's hot out there, and just making sure the team is doing safe. And we also coordinate for all the logistics coming back to site as well, redeployment, getting out there, and making sure our team is successful.
That sounds like a lot of work.
It is. There's a lot of background work that we do, but then to make the team successful.
When you're on location at one of these recovery efforts, is once you get there, is most of the work done because you've done all the planning, you've gotten all the equipment, that kind of stuff? Or is it just sort of a beginning? Yeah, you've gotten the plan, you've set everything up, but now there's stuff that you have to go through on a day by day to execute and make everyone else successful.
So work just begun when you get on site, even though with all the pre-planning. So when we get on site, we're counting for how many local workers we have on site. If there's any variables with weather, especially when thunderstorms are coming through or typhoons are coming through, we have to make weather call. Or how are we going to preserve the site without if there's weather coming through, or if it's super hot. If there's some variable control that we can't forecast or prevent, how do we react to that? For example, if the worker, say we request 50 workers and only 10 shows up, how do we use the team effectively with the limited resources we have? So it's constantly talking back with our host partners and the detachments out in Vietnam to give them update and, hey, we need more resources. We need less resources. We need to shift this because of it's too hot out, as out there, past 130 degrees, we can't do full workday because it's just way too hot. So we'll mitigate as much as we can. Or there's a typhoon that's coming in, so we can't go on site. So we have to make those calls on site. So it's always, you're always adapting to the changing variables when we're out there. Or another was a safety issue. If there's a UXO on site, how do you react to, what do we do to prevent the safety of the team members and the local workers out there?
Now, Will, during these two recovery missions where you all actually found and recovered Captain Forrester, was there anything super difficult about it? I mean, I know that it's difficult work, but in general, but was there anything unusual about that particular site or anything that really stood out to you as opposed to other sites that you had maybe worked on?
Yeah, probably the largest hurdle was the water control and mitigation. So like you pitch in a rice paddy, in some areas it's probably, you know, calf deep. In other areas it could go up to your waist in that rice paddy. So we get a little bit of training on cofferdamming. You know, open source stuff is you're hopping on there and you figure out how to cofferdam, what techniques to use, double-sided tarps and that kind of stuff. And, you know, every single day you're going to get some leakage and stuff like that coming back into the unit. So you go and pump all that stuff out every single day. You know, you'd have probably about four pumps at minimum down at the units, the area of excavation you've already dug to pump out all that water. And then by that time, like you're moving forward on that unit. So you do certain things. Maybe you pay a local to start pumps early. So by the time you get to the site, you're just kind of cleaning up the site a little bit, get everything squared away so you could hit the ground and start excavating. The heat was pretty bad, especially the second JFA I was on. So like we talked about it, heat index is about 122. So the middle of the day, we would have to halt work for about 2 hours just because of how hot it was. But that being said, like I still would keep a team out there for about 10 hours on site. So you're still kind of cooking. You're still pretty hot. Really, you know, like two very tough teams. And I got super lucky with that we were able to push through and do a ton of work on both JFAs. I think it was about, we did 30 4x4 units per JFA for both JFAs. So a giant area of excavation is what we were able to accomplish.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. Will, right now you work in our expeditionary support section. I know, Dave, you work in our Indo-Pacific section. Have you always been part of Indo-Pacific, or were you part of ES when you first got to the agency, Dave?
So when I first got to the agency, I was a team leader in ES, was there for about 2.5 years before I got moved up to the front office supporting DP leadership. And this past summer, I was moved down to IP to be the Southeast Asia planner.
Right. So ES, I feel like, doesn't always get a lot of time in the spotlight. Yes, there's a lot of photos because we always send a photographer out on these JFAs. So there'll be photos of the work that you do, but can you guys tell me, in addition to these recovery missions, what other stuff does ES take care of?
Yeah, I mean, so once it's kind of handed off, I kind of picture ES and these teams kind of as the tip of the spear. So you have decades of efforts, funding, resources, and hundreds of hands have touched this case and cases like it. And at that point, they're basically entrusting us and handing this mission off to the point of the spear, which is these teams going out. So failing really isn't an option. You have to work hard at that moment. So, you know, being physically fit is very important for us. Training up these STIAs prior to deployment is very important to us. So we go all over the world, of course, austere locations, diverse wildlife and mountain sites, all that kind of stuff. So we take these STIA in a very short amount of time, we train them up for the site they're going to. So if we're going to a mountain site, we're going to send them through, you know, a crash course in mountaineering. Hopefully they have some knowledge of that prior to. We're going to kind of assess their physical fitness as well. You know, we might take them up Cocoa Head. And if, you know, we're going to a very physically taxing site, and they're not physically ready for it, we might try to do a swap before we get in the country. We have that kind of freedom to do that, those moves internally once we get a whole JFA of STIAs coming in for about 3 recovery teams. So that's the kind of stuff we do on the front end. Everything else is just, you know, kind of preparedness, you know, making sure we're ready to deploy. We're forecasting accurately, you know, for the next fiscal year and the year after that. And we just fall into kind of the planning phases with IP or whatever directorate is controlling that mission at that time. And that's what we're here for. You know, we help out any way we can with planning and resourcing. And, you know, we take these STIA and we go all over the world with it. So it's kind of a crazy idea. You take these tiny little teams out there and kind of hodgepodge together, you know, a joint service team. And those are some of the finest, greatest people you ever meet, you know, from all, you know, walks of life, essentially. So it's an awesome experience.
Very cool. Very cool. So you mentioned STIA several times. For our listeners, can you explain what a STIA is?
So it stands for Short-Term Individual Augmentee. Because DPA is such a small organization and we don't have enough military personnel. So we ask the different, all the services, if they could augment our team. So we're looking for additional EOD medics, COMO, or any service members who is willing to dig and screen through dirt. So throughout the Indo-Pacific, we usually ask about 300 augmentees from different services to be part of our mission. In Europe, I think the number is about 100, 150 as well. So we get sailors, soldiers, airmen, Marines, and Guardians to come out to these missions. And it is very critical. We can't do our operations without them.
That's very cool that we actually reach out to all of the other services and get people from those services to come out and help us as well. So it really is a DOD-wide mission, not just something just from our joint agencies. That's a very cool thing. Gentlemen, those are all the questions that I have. Is there anything that we didn't touch on that perhaps that you would like to talk about? Anything about Captain Forrester or the family or the recovery or anything at all?
Personally, this mission is one of the most honorable missions that we have in DOD. We try to live up to our creed is I will never leave a fallen comrade. And sometimes it takes years, but we put the effort to account for all our service member. And knowing that as a service member, I take great comfort if I ever go missing or unaccounted. I have guys like Will who's going to come look for me years down the road, or anyone who comes after us at DPA, that we are still accounting for our service members.
Yeah, Sean, that's about it. You know, incredible mission. I'm glad to be a part of it. And we'll keep the wheels turning. Like, we want to get out there, we want to get out the door, and we want to bring them all home.
Absolutely. You know, there's still more than 1,500 missing from Vietnam, so I know our mission is never going to end, and hopefully we can find more people like Captain Forster and bring them back to their families who are still waiting for them. Gentlemen, thank you very much for taking the time out to talk to me today. I greatly appreciate it, and we will talk to you all again sometime in the future.
All right, thanks.
Thank you, Sean.
The effort our teams put into finding those still missing from America's past wars and conflicts is nothing short of astounding, and their personal dedication is inspiring. Please join us on the next episode of Missing and Not Forgotten, where we'll talk to scientists from our Scientific Analysis Directorate about the science that went into finding and identifying Captain Forster. In the meantime, thank you for listening to Missing and Not Forgotten, the official podcast of the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency.